frente que eu quero passar. Pois o samba já animado, o que eu quero é samba. Este samba que é misto de maracatu, é samba de preto veio, samba de pedudo. Na esquineta, um samba como este é tão legal. Você não vai querer que eu chegue no final.
Welcome to the French Connections Weekend Edition. Today's date is the 4th day of November 2006. My name is Daryl Bradford Smith. Great to have you all with me here today. As usual, we try to bring you provocative and interesting and timely interviews, and today is no exception with my good friend and collaborator in many of the efforts that we put out here, Christopher Bolin from Chicago and the world, for that matter. And Chris has been gracious enough to spend some time with us here on this weekend, on this Saturday. We've got lots to talk about with him regarding, well, the most recent election advertising went on in Chicago, as well as some of the stuff that was in that ad, and interesting things about AFP, and, well, we've got all kinds of things to talk about. His case, first of all. Chris, are you with me?
I'm here. Hello.
Great to have you with me, Chris. You know, it's interesting that so much has been going on here. I mean, first of all, let's start out with your case. I know you've had two delays so you could prepare a defense. Have they ever had a charge that they made against you? Because I remember the day that this happened when I was speaking to Halia. She said they didn't know why they arrested you. And to this day, I think they arrested you for resisting arrest.
Yes, that's correct. I was taken away. And then they wrote up a report and made the charges that I resisting arrest and aggravated assault against a peace officer, and those are both serious misdemeanors.
Yeah, but how can you resist? How can you resist arrest? You have to be arrested in the first place.
Well, that's the fundamental question. You know, I was the complainant. I had called 9/11. I had asked the police to send a representative to my house to explain this the presence of these three heavily armed men in this unmarked car loitering around my house. And the chief of police, is Clint Hertigan, in his infinite wisdom, sent this car. And these three men came up my driveway with their weapons and body armor and refused to identify themselves. And that's what basically caused the confrontation. I mean, they came. They were not wearing uniforms. They didn't have name tags, and they came to my house, and they didn't even say that they were responding to 9/11. To the 9/11 call. I'm sorry.
But Chris, you know, the logic is lost in my mind, and it was the very day that I got the call from Halia that first of all, to be charged with resisting arrest, you would have to have been arrested in the first place.
Right.
And
right.
Because that's not a charge. That's a charge subsequent to an arrest.
Right. And I had not been arrested. What I said I needed to do, when these men wouldn't identify themselves to my wife, and then I came out of the house and asked who they were, and they wouldn't identify themselves, then my daughter was very worried, and I said, I have to go in the house and get my brother, because my brother's, he studied law, and he's the person who lives in this house all the time. And when I went to get him, as I turned and went to the door, they tackled me from behind and broke my arm and tasered me.
Well, see, this to them was that they were just there to thump on you, it seems.
Well, it certainly looks that way because, you know, this happened in the middle of August, and I've never seen that car again with the three heavily armed men in this neighborhood before or since. And whatever gang suppression they were doing, their gang suppression training only lasted 2 days, and both days were around my house.
Have you ever seen a gang in your neighborhood, Christopher?
No, there's no gangs. This is a quiet residential, what they call a bedroom community, one of these suburban, you know, plywood box house areas. And they told my brother, though, they wouldn't tell me what they were there for. They wouldn't identify themselves. But my brother, he's older and he's bigger. And they, when they took him, when my brother saw them, you know, had me on the ground and knees, elbows on their knees on my head and everything, they told him as they took me away that they were a gang suppression unit. And that's what they were doing.
Well, so apparently today you have been declared a gang of one, apparently.
Yeah, that seems to be what was going on. I mean, when we went and spoke to a police officer later about this in September, he told us they were doing cross-training and that, you know, one was training the other two or two were training the other one, whatever. None of it makes any sense. What's interesting is that we did go to the police chief of police 2 days later. I said I wanted to file a complaint. And we sat down with the village manager and the chief of police, and he said, well, I'll tell you what we're going to do. We'll do an internal investigation. That internal investigation has never been done because they say that they require a signed affidavit from me. But my lawyer, my various lawyers have told me that I should not, you know, give the police anything more that they can prepare their case with. Anyway, they did have a pretty much detailed report that I put on the internet on the day of the event. But the chief told us at this meeting that he personally had decided to send this tactical unit, the very object of my fear and concern. He had decided to send this unit to my house to explain themselves. The police tried to say that they were the closest unit around and all this kind of stuff. That's nonsense because, you know, this 9/11 call was not responded to a half an hour after I had called. It took, you know, there was a delay of a half an hour.
Right.
Between the time that they were at my house the first time and the second time. So what, were they going around the block for a half an hour? it's all very transparent. You know, when you start telling lies, it's very much like the 9/11 thing. When you start telling lies, you know, you have to have other lies to support your first lies, and the whole case falls apart.
Well, you know, it's interesting that immediately after it happened, I think I was on the phone to that police department within a half an hour of you being arrested.
Yeah, you were very successful.
Well, we did. We got in, and I got Jim Condit involved right away. Of course, Eric and I both knew at the same time, and I got a lot of people to call other people, and boy, did they get a surprise, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. They got, the phone was ringing off the hook. They were just preparing to rough me up in the jail there. And I think your call certainly helped get me out a little bit sooner than I would have otherwise.
Yeah.
Because they, but you know, this is Hoffman Estates. I mean, these guys, people like to call this, some people call lawyers and things call this police force out here a cowboy, but that gives cowboys a bad name. These guys are sons and daughters, mostly sons of Chicago police officers. And as many of your listeners know, Chicago has a very bad record for police brutality and home invasion, things like that. This was almost a home invasion.
Yeah.
Except they didn't come into the home. They came out of the property.
Well, it's astonishing that this happened the way it did. Now, the subsequent things that are going on, you do have an attorney now, right?
Yes, I have an attorney. And he asked for a 30-day extension or so back when I was in court in October. And he got that until November 21st.
Mm-hmm.
November 21st will be, I suppose, some sort of a day of reckoning for me. I hope that I can, you know, resolve this matter. I'd really like to resolve this matter so I could really have freedom to travel.
Well, and the interesting thing, okay, is who is the next, who's the judge? Do you know?
Well, the judge, I don't know if it's always the same judge because I've had two judges. The first judge was a Greek woman, a Greek-American woman. The next judge was a man. And it's, I guess it's kind of like who comes along, but it's a circuit court of Cook County. It's in Rose by Arlington Park Racetrack.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose it's just the judge is serving that day.
Yeah.
I really don't know. I mean, this is a, you know, the legal process, the way things work in this country is, really a far cry from justice. It's amazing how so much of it is just simply pleas and negotiations between the two sides, the lawyers of the two sides. And I mean, I don't expect. I hope that I get a jury trial if they pursue this. That I get a jury trial.
Well, you know, the things in the country are falling apart, Christopher. And this election cycle is an important one for a lot of reasons. Of course, not the least of which is the way that that our Bill of Rights has been suspended and habeas corpus has been suspended, and now they're talking about having to get pre-permission to leave the country. That's supposed to be a law that's or a fiat color of law decision from the an administrative decision from the executive branch that says you can't leave the country without being first approved. This is
it's very important that you say that. I'm in the process of getting my son's passport renewed, and this is very interesting that after the first of the year, Americans will not be able to go to Canada or Mexico without a passport, or we won't be able to go on these cruises anymore to the Caribbean or Puerto Rico or whatnot without a passport. So that it's like the Soviet Union, you will need a passport to leave the country at the beginning of the year.
Yeah.
And who controls the passport authority? That's under the authority of Department of Homeland Security, which is, again, our friend Michael Chertoff.
Right. Let's get involved in his activity, because the ad that Jim Condit successfully had on for at least a day and a half was a pretty powerful statement about Mr. Chertoff and what many of us around the world think about him. What was in that ad, and what was its effect that you could see?
Well, he ran this ad on the Disney ABC radio station in Chicago, which is WLS, which is the talk radio station now. It used to be rock and roll in the 60s, but now it's talk radio. So that means that it the whole day is spent with this mindless rubbish coming from people like Sean Hannity and Ro Khan and Rush Limbaugh. It's basically completely pro. It's like a junta with the dictatorship. It's pro Bush all the way.
Yeah.
Questions of voting irregularity. People who question why we are in Iraq and Afghanistan are basically thrown off the stage with a pick. Whereas if you call into these shows and you're a soldier, you support the war, then you're a great American. It's that kind of stuff. I've never heard such. I listened to WLS in those last 2 days because I wanted to hear when I was monitoring the play of the ads. But it's really to listen to this kind of talk radio, like I said, you know, Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh, and then their local hosts like this Ro Khan fella. It is it's absolutely abusive. It's the most anti-intellectual radio I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah,
I would say it's the most offensive radio I've ever heard in my life, and I've heard some pretty offensive radio.
Well,
there's nothing like that in any other part of the world that I've been to.
Well, interesting. I know you tried to call to get in on the air, and so did I.
Mm.
And I didn't get past the screener.
Right? No, you're wrong. That's the gatekeeper. His name is Todd Rosenkowski, I think it's Rosenkowski, something like that. He was the gatekeeper, and this Ro Khan fellow, who's the local station host. Who talks to the Chicago area? He's a Jewish fella. And when he was when he was on the air on the second day, he got on. And he said, "My family's offended by this ad." You know, he's getting all these calls from his family, and that means his family was against this ad. I asked my wife. I said, "Who would be offended by this? You know, who's in love with Michael Chertoff to the degree that they're going to be offended by this ad?" Because the ad basically said that I think it's called the Arrest Chertoff ad.
Yeah.
Calls for that the Director of Homeland Security is part of the problem, part of this criminal gang, and he should be arrested for his involvement in
the fact that he's a dual citizen of Israel, right?
Well, that's not an arrestable offense, but the fact that he
it should be.
That he was covered for 9/11, that he was involved in the cover up of the 1993 bombing, the hoax bombing that started the whole thing back in 1993.
That's right.
And also for his criminal negligence in the response to Hurricane Katrina.
Yep.
He was the federal authority. He was the federal official responsible for the federal government's response to Hurricane Katrina. And as we all know, he dropped the ball big time.
Well, yeah, he did, but here's the other side of this guy. Wasn't his family very instrumental in early stages of the intelligence apparatchik in Israel?
Oh, his family was very key in the creation of the state of Israel. Now let's back up a minute. I have to tell you that I've warned repeatedly over the years not to talk about Michael Chertoff. As Eric Kirschman knows, when I was speaking in London when we were there on the Jimmy Walter tour, an individual came up to us. I think he's a high-ranking journalist with Time Magazine or Newsweek. His name escapes me for the minute. But he came up and he actually got down on his knees in the hotel in London and begged me, do not talk about Michael Chertoff. He also asked me not to talk about depleted uranium at the World Trade Center. But he said, do not talk about Michael Chertoff. Please, he said, the people don't understand it. But it made no sense to me. But now I've been getting emails that say the exact same thing from people saying that they're very worried that I'm in danger and that I shouldn't talk about Michael Chertoff. Now, wait a minute. Let's back up a minute. Michael Chertoff is the man who oversees the Department of Homeland Security. Prior to that, he oversaw the Criminal Division of the Department of Justice from July of 2001.
Yeah.
He's the person who oversaw what I call the non-investigation of 9/11.
Yeah.
He's the person as the U.S. attorney for the District of New Jersey. He's the person who had control of the evidence and prosecution of the first bombing at the World Trade Center.
Ramzi Youssef.
Beg your pardon?
Ramzi Youssef.
Yes, and Mr. Saleh, Mohammed Saleh, I think is his name, the informant, the FBI informant, who was paid $1 million to basically hire these guys in the mosques of the Bronx and Brooklyn in order to, you know, go through the action, you see?
Yeah.
And then, what, three of these guys from these mosques and from the 1993 bombing case wound up being in Oklahoma City on the day of the Oklahoma City bombing. I mean, it's all so obvious. But people are saying that I shouldn't talk about Michael Chertoff. And I say, what is this, the Soviet Union? I mean, is this guy holier than Lenin? I can't, you know, ask who is this person? Well, that's what the mainstream media in this country has done. They have never written an analysis or a biographical article about Michael Chertoff, who he is, where he comes from, who his parents are, his connection to the State of Israel. Now, the Chertoff family is pretty new to this country. They came here in 1900. The first two Chertoffs were, I think, Noah and Julia, who may be Julietta. Julia, they were going back to the old country, to Poland and Russia, to bring back more Chertoffs.
Yeah.
And I think Noah passed away, and then Etta had these boys, and then Paul, one of them, and that's Chertoff's grandfather. And then his grandfather had two sons and a daughter who grew up in the 20s and the 30s. Now, Michael Chertoff's father is a man named Baruch, or Gershon Baruch Chertoff. He's a rabbi. And then he's got an uncle Mordechai, who's also a rabbi.
Mm-hmm.
And his grandfather was a very well-known teacher of the Talmud in this Jewish theosophical sort of whatever, their society in New York City, which became the Jewish Institute.
Okay.
And so his father was, but the sister was the head of Hadassah, the Junior Hadassah, and she was a big fundraiser for the State of Israel in the 30s, bringing back, you know, millions of dollars to Palestine. She went to school at Hebrew University before Israel was a state. You know, their family was one of the founding families of the State of Israel.
Yeah.
And that has to be understood, that you know, at the same time that, like, Benjamin Netanyahu's father is working with the New Zionist Movement in New York, Michael Chertoff's aunt is working with the Zionist movement in New York and Chicago and London.
Well, let's move one family member aside there. Wasn't his cousin or nephew in responsible for the messed up job that Popular Mechanics complete farce investigation piece was done, and didn't they try to separate the fact that they were related?
Yeah, well, no, debunking 9/11, the debunking 9/11 issue from the Popular Mechanics was written, I think, in March of 2005 or something like that.
Yeah.
It was a senior researcher at the time of that newspaper, who's now an editor of another sort, is Benjamin Chertoff.
Yeah.
Who, you know, I tracked down his mother and spoke to his mother, and she said, well, yeah, they're cousins. So she said that he was a cousin with, Michael Chertoff. She didn't say anything about being a distant cousin. She didn't say anything about third or second or fourth. She said cousin, which, you know, for most people, that means like a first cousin. But you understand how cousin is thrown around. Sometimes it means second cousin or whatnot.
Yeah.
Now, she was very proud of the fact, and then her husband was very quick to grab the phone, her new husband, and say, I told you, I don't want you calling this house or something, because he realized then it was me again. He was being the gatekeeper for former Mrs. Chertoff. And he told me, this wife told me, that Larry Chertoff, a man named Larry Chertoff, who I believe is an authority with the New York City Department of Environmental, what is it, EPA.
Yeah,
the Environmental Protection Agency. The New York has their own environmental protection group, and Larry Chertoff, that's his father, is in that group, is an official, was an official in that department, for the water. I think it's the water quality of New York City. Maybe water and air. But now, that's what I found out, but you know, I don't have a lot of inside information besides the telephone and visiting people, but I go to the local library and I look into these old newspaper records as best as I can. The New York Times has a pretty good, you know, database, and I would read about the Chertoff family. It's interesting. You know, I told you there were two Chertoffs who came to the country in 1900, Noah and Julia, and they went back and got, you know, sons and daughters and cousins and whatnot. And one of the Chertoffs, was an arsonist and would bring baby buggies soaked with kerosene into tenement houses in New York and then light the baby buggy. I don't know if his name was Lewis. There was another one who was a flag burner. So they seemed to be an incendiary group. Another one was a flag burner, and he was involved with a group of, I think it's called Internationalists. Back in the 1917, a group that
ties to communism, if you will.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The international movement, and they went through a legal process in New York for burning the U.S. flag.
Well, now you, everyone should know, if they don't, and I'll bring them up to speed. The Homeland Security is not the only thing that this man has access to. He also, because of his ties to the Justice Department, has direct access to FBI activity as well, doesn't he? Does he not?
Oh, yeah. Well, this is the thing. When you talk about the Department of Justice, you have to remember that for a long time, the director and the people that run the Department of Justice in the United States have been very, very warm Jews. In the time of, I think it was the first Bush, it was a man named Abraham Sofayer. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but it, you know, he was a friend of Israel. Then when we had John Ashcroft, we had the real brains of the outfit was Michael Chertoff. Ashcroft was just the non-Jew who's supposed to be the warm and fuzzy guy that everybody sees. But like, for example, Michael Chertoff is the one who wrote the Patriot Act along with a Vietnamese-born colleague at the Department of Justice. I mean, these two people are the ones that put together this notorious, infamous, 15,000-page legislation, however long it is, that's taken away a lot of our liberties in this country.
Well, doesn't it come, much of it come right out of the playbook from Russia?
Yes.
I mean, they used actual laws and sedition laws and whatnot from the Russian model, did they not?
Well, the police departments in this country, going back to my arrest, you know, we wonder who is behind the arrest. But all of the police departments today in the United States liaise, communicate with the Department of Homeland Security. In every police department in the United States, there is an official, usually the chief or a high-ranking lieutenant, who corresponds, who is the liaison with the Department of Homeland Security. So I called up the local police department here, and I asked them, you know, what kind of relationship do you have with the Department of Homeland Security? He says, we work very closely with the Department of Homeland Security. He says, we work very closely.
Mm.
And this is the Schaumburg Police Department, which is, I live on the border of Schaumburg and Hoffman Estates. The Hoffman Estates officials, knowing who I am and everything, were more reluctant to talk about this. But Schaumburg, which is the older and bigger town, they were very forthright. They said yes, and there's a lieutenant here who is the liaison. And I said, well, does Homeland Security tell you what to do? And he says, well, if Homeland Security tells us to do something, we do it. So it's not beyond, it's not difficult to imagine that somebody at Homeland Security said, well, you go surveil closely Mr. Boleyn. We know that he's back. We know he's been back for 2 weeks. We know he's at home. So you just go by and let him know that you're there. That seems to be what they're doing. You know, people come by my house and will tell me, I just got a job with this FBI, they'll say, a person who I've known for years. He come by the other day and says, you know, I just got a part-time job with the FBI. And this guy being a Lebanese fella, you know, we interrogated him. And we didn't put him on the rug, but I said, you know, my wife said, oh, yeah? Yeah? Because, you know, these are exactly the kind of people that they will want to recruit. People who already know you. People who are friends of yours.
Yeah.
And people who have access to your home. I mean, this is, you know, when people say, we don't want the police state coming in our grandchildren's time. No, it's here.
It is here.
This is the thing about Americans is that they do not perceive the reality they're living in. They think that they have free elections, but they don't seem to mind that their votes are not being counted. They're simply putting in input to the process, and they think that that's an election. They think that's democracy. They think they have a democratic franchise. It's the same thing I say about the houses people live in. You look at the houses they're building here in the United States. They're basically plywood, plastic shells. I mean, you know, they build better houses for their animals in Germany.
That's
But and people pay $500,000 for these monstrosities. I can't believe it. All across the country. You know, it's a people. American people are more and more people who are living in a virtual reality, and it's a virtual reality which is false.
Well, it's no surprise to me. I mean, having lived out of the country for a time and seen the you know, I've been all over the world, and you know that I have a different take on this mess. I remember when we first were in contact with one another, you were being harassed at home by some insider people who turned out to be very suspicious, and I'm certain that they were sicked on you by this same group.
Well, we knew. I think maybe that was the time we left the country last fall. I mean, the fall of 2004, I guess 2005. We left the country in the fall of 2005 because we learned that two people who were befriending us were actually FBI informants. That was a pretty serious development. But I mean, I've known that the FBI has been surveilling me, since the first Gulf War in 1991 because of my opposition to the war. And you know, that's alarming because the FBI I consider to be an outfit with criminal leadership. I know there's probably a lot of good FBI guys, and they try to get rid of them as fast as they can, like John O'Neill. But the FBI in my mind is clearly responsible in the cover up of 9/11.
Absolutely.
Look, you don't look any further than the confiscation of the evidence of the Pentagon, or what they did at the Pentagon crime scene, or what they've done with it's very clear.
Well, and what they did in advance to set the story up when one of their own found out information, Agent Rowley, Colleen Rowley, up in I think it was Wisconsin, she said, "Hey, there's all kinds of suspicious stuff happening, guys." And they said, her superior said, "Don't pay any attention to that. It's not your business." And she's saying, "But wait a minute, there's something going on here." And they just poo-pooed her and said, "Shut up and go do something else."
Well, you see, that's what our friend Salvador Astucia, he wrote back to me. He's the author of a book about the murder of John Lennon and how the FBI has been killing these rock stars for years. You ask her, where's the music gone? Because there's no anti-war music in this country anymore. We have now 5 years of these illegal and disastrous wars, and there's no anti-war music. You have to say, what's happened? You know, I grew up in the 60s, and anti-war music was, mainstream music then.
Yeah.
And the Woodstock thing and all of the protests against the war, when there's something like 70% of the American people who are opposed to this war, this current war in Iraq and Afghanistan, these bloody, treacherous quagmires where there's no end in sight, and our leaders tell us there's no end in sight. When something like 70%, two out of three Americans are against this war, there's not a single mainstream Democrat candidate who's coming out and saying, stop these illegal wars, bring the troops home, and let's investigate the seminal event of these wars. Let's do a blue ribbon investigation of 9/11. Because most Americans don't even understand that there has not been a blue ribbon investigation. They, they dressed up the 9/11 Commission up as some sort of investigation. No, it has to be a forensic investigation of the evidence.
Yeah.
Stolen
yeah.
and otherwise.
Well, it did not happen. And it didn't happen. And of course, we've got our supporters. We've got people that are patriotic, are hoping that this information can be sussed out and brought to the public. Stephen Jones comes to mind. You've met with him personally. I've had conversations with him. We're not best of friends, but we certainly know each other well.
Right.
I'm wondering what your latest information from Stephen is and what his efforts are at the moment.
Well, he wrote back to me because I'm having an event. I'm having an event on Remembrance Day, Armistice Day, otherwise known as Veterans Day in this country. On the 11th of November, I'm having another event at the Schomburg Library, a three-hour event for serious discussion of 9/11 and evidence of the hoax. And I'm going to be, and so I invited, of course, Eric Hufschmid and Stephen Jones, because those two people are people that I research with and have, you know, had a lot to say about this. Eric, I don't think he's coming out here. That's a long way for him, but I was hoping Stephen Jones might come here. He's going to be speaking in San Francisco that day, so he won't be able to come, but I'll be discussing his evidence. But, you know, the thing is that it was the discovery of the molten metal that I learned that molten metal had been found in the three basements of the World Trade Center.
Yeah.
And I remember Eric Hirschman at the time just – He and I disagreed on this. He said, no, it can't be molten metal, you know, 4 weeks, 5 weeks after the event with all the water being sprayed on the rubble. And I said, well, Eric, that's what the guy told me. He said, literally molten steel. He called it steel. And this, of course, piqued the interest of Stephen Jones, because he's an expert in cold fusion and metals and whatnot, how they behave. And, you know, he called me and wanted to get exactly what these people told me, who and when and what they said. And that's when he began his investigation of the molten metal at the World Trade Center. And, of course, his conclusion is that this was a thermite, an aluminum thermic reaction, for example, what we see on the 81st floor of the South Tower before it collapsed, where all of this white smoke is, there's these what they call pressure pulses, NIST calls them pressure pulses, and they go shooting out the window at a high velocity.
Well, you can also see the molten metal actually pouring out.
First you see the explosion.
Yeah.
Then you see the white smoke. Then you see the molten metal. And, you know, I've seen thermite reactions. I know Eric's done them in his backyard and things. But Professor Jones did one in one of his classrooms, and I watched it. It is an explosive reaction. And, of course, if you add the 2% sulfur to the mix, then you get an extremely explosive reaction. That's called thermite. But in any case, you know, the question has been, as I posed it since 2001, since September, when I addressed the construction of these buildings, the fundamental question was, what happened to the central columns? Because the two towers would not have fallen if the 47 box columns that make up the core of the building had not been severed. And
right.
The government, all of this explanation that this was pancaking floors, what have you, does not explain what made those central columns fail. And so when we discovered this presence of this molten metal, I wrote very clearly, I said that this is a clue as to what happened to the central columns, because the molten metal was found at the base of the central columns in buildings 1, 2, and also 7, which was the building that fell at 5:20 in the afternoon. And, of course, Stephen Jones begins his presentation with building 7, because that is the absolute anomaly that stands out the most. You know, this building was two blocks away, collapsed at 5:20 in the afternoon. And, of course, the media doesn't want to talk about it.
But well, no, in fact, the farce that they called the 9/11 investigation didn't even bring up Building 7. They left it out of their conversation.
Right. The engineer's report, the building performance, did talk a little bit about it. They said, we don't know why it fell. So the 9/11 commission did not even go there, did not even address it.
Yeah.
And the NIST report is now like 2 or 3 years overdue. Now we're expecting it like in the spring of 2007. But the NIST people are very, they produce these tens and thousands of pages of documents, mostly on CD. And, but I've looked at them, you know, I have the appendix, I'm going to show these pictures. The appendix, shows clearly for the South Tower, massive amounts of molten metal pouring off the east corner of the 81st floor. It looks like the second floor of the Fuji Bank, which was, I think, empty at the time. Massive amounts of molten iron falling off the building. I mean, this is tons of the stuff.
Yeah.
And it's important to understand, that means that tons of thermite must have been brought into the 82nd floor, 81st floor, prior to the attack. So
now, how did they get all that stuff in there, other than the vans that we've pointed to in some of my reports? They came up with bomb-sniffing dogs reacted positively to some moving vans that were pulled over right after the event, didn't they?
Yeah. Well, the thing is, what's interesting about that is that the thermite is a powder mix. It's aluminum mixed with ferrous oxide, and like I said, maybe 2% of sulfur. So it's a powder mix. And, you know, in my imagination, you know, limited as it is as an innocent person, I just think that maybe I was thinking if the floor was really occupied, maybe they brought it in those large ashtrays they have in high-rise buildings, you know, that by the elevators you might have those large pots that look like sand.
Yeah.
And because we're talking about tons of the stuff. Okay, ferrous oxide, you know, iron oxide and aluminum powder are fairly heavy, but you have to have tons of that stuff. And it has to be placed in such a way that it's going to cut the beams and cut through them. Because what thermite does is that it's an exothermic reaction. It creates extremely hot temperatures, and then it slices through the steel like a warm knife through butter. And the thing is that this, you see, there must have been a hell of a lot of thermite in there because, of course, they used a lot of redundancy. And I would assume that that's what kept reacting down there in the base of the rubble, which continued this exothermic reaction, which is what, you know, the extreme heat. Now, you know, my trip out west this spring, I first met with Professor Jones in Provo in March, and then I went out to California and met Professor Thomas Cahill. And Professor Thomas Cahill and the guys at Davis, they're not conspiracy people. They're University of California people. These are the people who take care of the nuclear program, right?
Yeah.
And they are not at all willing to discuss conspiracy stuff. But I went to UC Davis, and so I talked to Professor Cahill, and the thing is that what his analysis of the plumes of smoke that were coming from the World Trade Center showed. Now, mind you, they didn't start measuring with this Davis drum in Manhattan until October 3rd. And they kept up their monitoring of the air until Christmas time when the fires were finally put out. If you remember, the fires burned the World Trade Center until December 28th or something, December 24th.
Yeah.
So now what's interesting is that in the plumes of smoke that were coming from the World Trade Center, drifting over north of Manhattan, were primarily ultra, ultra fine particles, which we call nanosized particles. These are 1/10 of a micron and smaller in diameter. These, and I, Professor Jones, you know, your spectroscopy, your analysis shows that these plumes of smoke contained primarily ultra fine particles of that nanosized range. And I said, what could possibly explain the creation of ultra fine, you know, nanosized particles? He said, only temperatures above the boiling point of the elements involved. That means that the fires that were raging in the rubble and beneath the rubble of the World Trade Center were at or above the boiling temperature of iron, of aluminum, of vanadium, of all these various elements that were in. I mean, the boiling temperature, you look up the boiling temperature of metal and things, these metals, these are extremely hot temperatures. There's no way that was caused by anything other than some exotic explosive, like an aluminothermic reaction.
Well, now, we've got, you know, here's the interesting thing, Chris. You and I have been working at this. Eric's been working at it, and Jim Condit, and so many people across the country. Fact is, why can't we get people to take a risk with us, to take a chance with us? I mean, there are some of them. I mean, and I want to thank all of you out there who are listening right now. But you know, we're still in the 10, 15, 20,000 range. I mean, we've got a country of 300 million. We've got a world of 6.4 billion. What is going on with
that?
Well, it's primarily
the control of the media. Of course, it's primarily the control of the media. Like we saw here in Chicago this week, you know, Jim Condit, as a candidate for Congress in Cincinnati, Ohio,
yeah,
placed some ads on WLS radio in which he talked about Chertoff and then the arrest Chertoff and free Bolin, that Bolin being me, because I was went through this incident getting beaten up and stuff and tasered. The ads ran for one day, and at night WLS radio reaches 38 states, and, you know, for truck drivers, people up at, late at night. But in the daytime, it reaches just the Chicago metropolitan area, which includes northern Indiana and southern Wisconsin, what have you. But it's a larger, it's like 11 million people. And these ads were like 30 seconds or maybe a minute, and they spilled out that I had been writing about 9/11 and that I've been revealing, Israeli involvement in 9/11. And it's this that he says is, you know, the reason why he's placing these ads in Illinois. But after a day and a half, one full day and a half, these ads were pulled. Now, that's very important. You know, when I realized these ads were pulled, I heard the last one at 2:33 on the 2nd, 2:33 in the afternoon. Then they were pulled, the rest of them. And that means that this radio station, which belongs to the Disney people, Disney Corporation, that they're willing to challenge this FEC ruling that a radio station or a television station has to give reasonable access to political candidates. They cannot edit or censor a political ad, you know, for a political candidate. And that's what they're doing here exactly. So Jim Kahn is of the mind that, they're willing to take their chances, to risk everything, and maybe they're going to try and make a new law out of this. And that's, that would be that, you know, ads that are maybe designed or thought to be anti-Semitic, because that's what one of the complaints that this Ro Khan had. He said that these ads are anti-Semitic.
How could that be? How could that be?
Because he identifies Sheratov as a Russian Jew. And if you realize in the Soviet Union, it was a capital offense to identify a Jew as a Jew. You could not call, Vladimir Lenin a Jew. You could not call somebody a Jew if they were not a Jew. That was one of the most serious offenses. I think it was Lenin who passed that law, or that ruling, that if you were identify a person as a Jew, you would be killed. And that's kind of the thinking here too, because that's what he says. He says but if you listen to the tone of the ads on the radio and TV in this country at this political time of year, they can trash anybody, but Sheratov is protected.
Yeah.
See? You can trash Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and this governor, this congressman. You can call them perverts or child abusers, whatever you want. The kind of things they call me. but Sheratov is beyond reach. You see, that's what I'm saying. It's the same thing. This is the man who controls the borders of the United States. He controls the Coast Guard. He controls the Immigration Naturalization Service, which is now called Citizens Service and Immigration, or something like that. He controls the Palace Guard. He controls the Secret Service. Now, that's important. That used to be under the Department of the Treasury. He controls the people who protect the president, the vice president, and people like John F. Kennedy, Jr., and all those various sons and daughters of presidents are protected by Secret Service. He controls that agency. So he controls the security of the nation. He controls TSA, Transportation Services Agency, whatever.
Well, the TSA, right. That's right.
At the airport.
Yeah.
He controls, and so he controls the borders, if you will. He controls this new apparatus that we were talking about. Who gets to get out of the country? Who gets to get in the country? I mean, you know, this guy is in the highest seat. He controls who protects and how they protect the president of the United States. So, like I said in one of my latest postings, I said, well, you know, it's a picture of Bush and Sheratov, and I said, well, Bush better be smiling. He better smile. You know,
yeah.
cross your eyes at Sheratov, and he might be dead tomorrow.
Well, he looks like quite an evil character, and his eyes are just black as coal.
Yeah,
and
he's a very, very
dangerous man.
He's lost a lot of weight. He used to be used to have some flesh on his face. Now he's got a face that, you know, you can see his skull. And he does resemble Lenin, but I not to be funny or anything, but when I first saw his picture, I actually thought that this fellow had AIDS because his face is so emaciated. He has no flesh on his face. I know he jogs and everything, but my God, he doesn't eat anything. I don't know. He looks like Lenin with AIDS because his face is so drawn and emaciated. And I thought, well, he won't last very long, but he'll probably outlast all of us.
Yeah,
But there's one thing I want to say about this. One interesting side note is that the Sheratov family, Paul Sheratov, the son, naturalized in Cleveland, Ohio with his mother, who's listed in the census as Etta. I think Etta is actually Julietta. So I think that Julia Sheratov, the one that went back to get the family, was the mother. And they what's interesting is that they naturalized. They became U.S. citizens in Cleveland, Ohio. They lived in Cleveland, Ohio, which is the same place where we have very strange incidents occurring on 9/11. You know, notably the landing of these two planes. One that was called Flight 93, United Flight 93.
Well, didn't we have two locations where there was anomalies? And then Stewart Air Force Base, there was arrivals, and what they said was after they crisscrossed over top of Stewart, didn't they get a change in the air signal, in the FAA signal that the plane puts out? It shifted right over top of the. In other words, they all have transponders that put out a signal.
Yeah,
and when the one plane came in, it was transponder number blah blah blah,
yeah.
And when it went over this Air Force base, the transponder setting changed mysteriously.
The plane changed.
The plane changed.
The plane changed.
There you go.
What's interesting about that is, of course, Stewart Air Force Base, or what used to be Stewart Air Force Base, is now in the International Airport. It's privately owned. It's owned by a British company, and it is within the New York Metro flight area. So that the thing is that it's not if the strike planes originated, the planes that hit the World Trade Center, if they originated in Stewart, they would never have crossed another center. They would have just been in New York Center the entire time. What's interesting about the Sheratov connection to Cleveland is that Cleveland was the center of the Jewish crime network for many years. And we have in Cleveland, we have Sam Miller,
yep.
The father of Aaron Miller, who is basically the State Department director for the Middle East for decades. And he's the son of Sam Miller and Ruth Ratner. The Ratner family is a huge family which owns immense amounts of property, but more importantly, they control a great deal of U.S. Navy real estate, places like Great Lakes Naval Training and whatnot. These are properties that are controlled by the Ratner family, their company called Forest City Enterprises. They manage for the U.S.
They manage
Navy.
The base?
They manage whole bases. Yeah. They manage entire Navy facilities. If one were to go to Forest City Enterprises, which is the name of that company that Sam Miller is the head of, you'll see that. And now what's interesting about this, you'll see all the listing. Go to the, you know, it's just amazing how much property they own. Real estate property, residential property, government property, etc. They manage and control, own, develop, what have you. What's interesting about this is that this Miller family, Sam Miller, the father of Aaron Miller, of the State Department, and he married into the Ratner family. This Sam Miller was also the person who was controlling the mayor of Cleveland at the time, a man named Michael White, a black man named Michael White. Michael White has now retired into central Ohio where he raises alpacas, llamas.
Yeah.
He doesn't want to talk. He doesn't want to talk to anybody. He says, I'm out of the business of giving, interviews. And he didn't want to talk about it, but it's very important because, you know, he as the mayor of Cleveland at 9/11 was the authority who could give the command to close the airport. That's very interesting. That airport was closed and everybody at the airport was sent home before these planes landed, you know, before this stuff happened. You know, and that's a very odd thing. What, you close the airport and send anybody home in Cleveland? And that's what they made people walk away from the airport. People had to go out on the highway and hitchhike and get rides on buses, you know. And so they vacated the airport. And then we had these two mysterious planes landing, one landing at the north end of the airport, one landing at the south end of the airport, and some people being taken off into the Expo Center, and the other people being taken off into the NASA Center. It's very odd. It's very odd. And you know, the Associated Press reported, a wire story from September 11th reported in a very short article of about 150 words, that indeed that was Flight 93 that landed. And United Airlines had confirmed to the Associated Press that that was Flight 93 that landed. You see? Who's here? Us. The people who you know, like me, who go on the evidence. Now, it's very important. These wire stories are very important because wire stories, you know, they're for newspapers. The only newspaper or agency that picked it up was this WCO, I think it is in Cincinnati. But this story was very important. It was never taken down. It was never changed. Eventually, the radio station or the TV station in Cincinnati, a year and a half later, said, "Well, that story was factually incorrect, and we took it away."
Well, you know, Chris, we're getting up to about an hour now, and I want to ask you a favor. I mean, we haven't touched on half the subjects I want to discuss with you. Could we schedule in the next upcoming days another session where we can discuss some of the events within the movement, this so-called truth movement, and some of the deceivers and some of the false storytellers that are out there? And I want to get into that, but I think that we've touched
absolutely.
On
this. I mean, that's absolutely what that'd be good to talk about, because that's what's gotten me, you know, fired, and that's what's gotten me, they're trying to push me to the margin. It's interesting to note that I was fired from my job after this attack by these undercover guys. And my newspaper, Willis Cardo and American Free Press, very quickly started collecting money for my legal defense fund. Then on September 7th, 2 weeks later, the ADL put out a national press release that I was making these conspiratorial anti-Semitic theories or whatever. And all the time I was being attacked by this Wing TV people, Scott McCufka, also Victor, also known as Victor Thorne. And then a month later, a month after the ADL attacked me, my paper fired me. And they have chosen to circulate the books and promote the books of a guy named Victor Thorne, who is he's a well-known, you know, pornographer. He wrote pornography. In 2001, 2002, while I was investigating 9/11, he was writing a magazine, an online magazine called Babble, which talked about his fetishes with plastic dolls and masturbation, what have you. I mean, I'm sure there's an audience for that, but you know, when I was digging into the rubble and finding out about seismic shocks and what was in the bottom of the World Trade Center, he's writing about his love affair with a plastic doll. And our newspaper, American Free Press, was always thought of as being a family paper that promotes things like homeschooling and you know, American fundamental values, basic values, and they've allied themselves with this person who's a pornographer, and his girlfriend is a woman who's left her three children and run off to be with this guy. And when I started asking, why is this guy publishing books by Michael Piper? Why is this guy making decisions? Why is this guy attacking me and you're not doing anything about it? Then they fired me.
Well, and interesting that Eustace Mullins said when he arrived at the conference, he was running around like the cock on the walk at this conference, and did not come over to Eustace, because Eustace told me, he said, he never came over to me. He looked at me kind of sheepishly, but he was walking around there like he was one of the owners, and he was jawboning with Stat Miller and the rest of these people. And now, you know, we've got a guy named Abramson over at RBN, and it seems to be a Zionist Jew radio network now, where I started out doing my work.
Zionists control the media in this country. That's what I mean. That this whole country is living a virtual reality, like the Truman Show, in which they're looking at these Zionist reflections on their television screens and thinking that's reality. Which is what I'm saying about in Europe. In Europe, of course, there's this propaganda in Germany and France. You know, they're occupied or they're controlled, media controlled. But not like in this country. Europeans and people in other parts of the world seem to be more grounded in reality. Whereas in this country, people are living a kind of a fairy tale. I mean, yeah. These wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, only today, I don't know, you don't get the New York Times over there, but today the New York Times, they finally are showing pictures. They show a picture of a poor guy, a sergeant, who's been shot in Iraq by a sniper. And they have a war picture, the kind of pictures you and I saw in the Vietnam time every single day on the nightly news, right?
Yeah.
Only now, what is it, a couple days before Election Day, are these photos being put on the front of the New York Times. Only now. You know, the New York Times promoted this war back when Judith Miller was writing her propaganda pieces, you know.
Yeah.
But now they, you know, they want to be seen as an anti-war paper or start to show the cause. Why haven't the American people been seeing these pictures for the last 4 years, 5 years in the case of Afghanistan and 3.5 years in the case of Iraq? The American people are not aware of the real cost of these events. That's why my Veterans Day event on 9/11, I'm going to be talking about the hoax of 9/11 or the evidence of 9/11. Let them decide. And you know, 5 years into the war on terror. And that's Veterans Day. That's November 11th in the Schomburg Library.
Well, I urge everybody to show up. And Chris, can we schedule something for maybe Tuesday or Wednesday this week? Will you be around?
Yes. Yes.
I'd like to do another interview talking about some of this other stuff that we didn't get to. It's important to let people digest what we just went through, because we went through an awful lot of information, and we can do a whole series of other subjects.
Yeah, we'll do that. But Tuesday, I'm going to be down in Chicago, looking at how the private company is running our elections. Every election day, I go down to the Chicago clerk's office, and I ask to have access to the room where the computer is. And every year I'm told, well, that's only for ES&S personnel back there. Or last time they said, that's only for Sequoia personnel. And I went near that back room and I found out who the Sequoia personnel were. They were all Venezuelans. They were all Venezuelan guys. But, of course, the company's not Venezuelan-owned. It's owned by, the question is, whether Sequoia is owned by Chavez or controlled by Chavez. It's a shell company. It's probably run by some guys out of New York.
Well, why don't we save it Wednesday after you've been able to get some other interesting stuff?
That's a good idea. Let's do that.
Okay, that's wonderful, Chris. It's been a wonderful hour with you as always. You know, we don't have a long history, but we've been working together quite effectively over the last few years here. And I got to tell you, you know, there's very few of us out here putting out the truth, Chris.
Yeah, and they're trying to make that number even smaller. You know, they fired Professor Jones, and they fired. We'll hang in there. We'll do what we can.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Daryl Bradford Smith. I want to thank you for listening to this broadcast with Christopher Bolin today. And we will be back with more from Chris on a day next week, probably Wednesday. So please tune into it. Until then, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for listening, and be well. Bye-bye now.